Some of the men playing in this year's NCAA tournament will go on to lucrative careers in the NBA. And with an average annual salary of more than $5 million, that will very likely make those men the primary breadwinners in their families. But in her new book, The Richer Sex, journalist Liza Mundy argues that traditional breadwinning roles are being flipped upside down, and now many women are carrying their families financially. We started off by asking Mundy to read a section of her book.
In a matter of decades, the traditional male breadwinner model has given way to one where women routinely support households and out-earn the men they are married to, and nobody cares or thinks it's odd. The Hawkins family, sane, functional, rooted in a Midwestern state known for family values, offers a convincing vision of what America is becoming. We are entering an era where women, not men, will become the top earners in households. We are entering the era in which roles will flip as resoundingly as they have done in this family. You laugh, but that big flip is just around the corner.
Tell me about the Hawkins family.
Well, this is a family of six adult siblings who grew up with a breadwinning dad in Detroit, worked for the auto industry, and they've found an adulthood. Three of the siblings are in traditional marriages, but where the woman is the primary earner. Two other women are in female breadwinning households, and there's one brother who is in a traditional breadwinning marriage. You know, in one generation, there's been a complete flip, a complete transformation.
The thesis you're putting out here, that women are becoming the primary breadwinners, that cuts across race, economic class, geographic location in this country?
Absolutely, yes. It used to be a phenomenon of poverty. It used to be if a woman was a breadwinner, it was likely because her husband couldn't get a job. But it's not anymore. The fastest gains have been among sort of upper economic demographics. So it really does cut across all sectors of society now.
What are the economic reasons behind this?
Well, I think one major positive cause is the fact that women have flocked to colleges and universities in the past two or three decades. Women achieved parity with men in the 1980s, and then they began outnumbering men on college campuses. And we are starting to see the economic rewards for women of that. And what economists have shown is that three-quarters of the jobs that were lost during the recession between 2007 and 2009 were jobs occupied by men. You know, it was called the man-cession. And as our economy hollows out and these high-paying sort of working-class jobs are to a certain extent going away, women have moved out of these middle sectors up into higher-paying jobs.
And you think this is a direct result of this most recent recession? This
well,
has really changed?
Certainly happening before the recession, but I think it became certainly more apparent and in some senses starker.
I'm speaking with Liza Mundy. Her new book is called The Richer Sex. And clearly we would presume that if women are earning more and becoming the primary breadwinner, that the glass ceiling in the workplace must have dissipated, no?
No, it hasn't. And, you know, women working full time still earn 81% of what men do. That's all women in all fields. And so the danger is that women will be supporting households on less than a man might make. What's interesting, even with this earnings disadvantage, women are out-earning their husbands, you know, a greater percentage every year.
How is this affecting family life? Are there more men who are raising their hand and saying, I want to stay home? And are women okay with that?
Well, in some cases, yes. I think, you know, what we're seeing, certainly what the statistics show is that men certainly want to spend more time with their children than men did a generation ago. So I think an increasing number of cases, men are willing to be the secondary earner. But I did interview women who were having trouble with this. And I interviewed one woman who said, much to her surprise, she said, you know what, my feelings changed. And I found myself respecting him less as a man. He was a great dad, but I felt differently.
You've talked with a lot of younger women about how this has affected the dating landscape. But I also wonder if you've seen any counter response to this trend. Some reporting I've read has suggested that there is a movement among women in their 20s who recognize that there's been a shift and they're opting to stay home, opting for a more traditional situation. Did you see any of that?
That wasn't the demographic that I was doing interviews among. But what the conflict I think that could create, and I'm sure there are women who are having that reaction, but what the studies also show is that men increasingly want to marry a well-educated, high-earning woman. They don't necessarily want to marry a woman who is going to opt out or stay at home. Psychologists have found, 40 or 50 years ago, when men were ranking traits that they were interested in a marital partner, domestic skills ranked pretty high. Domestic skills has plummeted and financial prospects has risen. So there may be now a mismatch if lots of women, with these great college degrees want to stay home, they may find that the men in their lives are saying,
The men want something different.
Yeah. You've got all this education. You've got all this earning potential. I'm willing to facilitate your career.
Do you have kids?
I do. I have a 16-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son.
How do you think their relationships might be different, their generation?
That's a really good question. I try in my book to take a very optimistic view that we'll move into a world where people make decisions, couples make decisions based on affinity. And if the woman is better suited to be the earner and the worker and the man is better suited to be the primary parent for a while, that will be widely accepted and will offer an abundance of choice for both men and women.
Author and journalist Liza Mundy. Her new book is called The Richer Sex. It goes on sale this week. She also has the cover story of Time magazine on newsstands now. Liza, thanks so much for coming in.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You can read an excerpt of The Richer Sex on our website, npr.org. And we'd like to hear from you on this topic. Do you live in a female breadwinner household? Is this good or bad for families? Visit Weekend Edition on Facebook and tell us what you think.
What makes people creative? How is it that some people can make things that make the rest of us applaud or marvel at, sometimes for centuries? The writer Jonah Lehrer, whose specialty is neuroscience, addresses that question in his new book, Imagine. Lehrer defines creativity broadly. The creations he considers range from masking tape to Broadway musicals and breakthroughs in mathematics, from memorable ad campaigns to Shakespearean tragedies, and he finds that the conditions that favor creativity are equally broad. Our brains, our times, our buildings, our cities. Jonah Lehrer, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first, can we really find common explanations for the success of the inventor of masking tape and Shakespeare, or are we lumping together apples, oranges, kiwi fruit, and much else?
Well, I think we absolutely can lump them all together. I think creativity, I think one of the mistakes we've made in talking about creativity is we've assumed it's a single verb, that when people are creative, they're just doing one particular kind of thinking. By looking at creativity from the perspective of the brain, we can see that creativity is actually a bundle of distinct mental processes. And so how we think, whether you're writing a Shakespearean tragedy or trying to come up with a new graphic design or writing a piece of software, that how we think about the problem should depend on the problem itself. That creativity is really a catch-all term for a variety of very different kinds of thinking.
I mentioned our buildings in the introduction. When Steve Jobs was at Pixar, you write, he was convinced that the layout of the building could either foster or impede creativity, where the restrooms were.
Yeah, and the original design for the Pixar Studios consisted of three separate buildings where they'd put the computer scientists in one building and the animators in a second building, and the third building would contain everybody else, the directors, the editors, and so on. And Steve realized that that was a terrible idea, that the real challenge of Pixar was getting people from these different cultures, these computer scientists and these cartoonists, to work together, to really collaborate. And so he insisted that Pixar Studios just be one vast cavernous space. And then he started moving everything to the atrium. So he started moving the mailboxes there and the cafe and the restaurant. And finally, and this was his last big idea, he insisted there'd be only two bathrooms in the entire Pixar Studios and that these would be in the central space. And of course, this is very inconvenient. No one wants to have to walk 15 minutes to go to the bathroom. And yet Steve insisted that this is the one place everyone has to go every day. And now you can talk to people at Pixar and they all have their bathroom story. They all talk about the great conversation they had while washing their hands.
Because he wanted there to be places where people who were trying to be creative would encounter other people who were trying to be creative.
Exactly. He wanted there to be mixing. He knew that the human friction makes the sparks, and that when you're talking about a creative endeavor that requires people from different cultures to come together, you have to force them to mix. That our natural tendency is to stay isolated, to talk to people who are just like us, who speak our private languages, who understand our problems. But that's a big mistake. And so his design was to force people to come together, even if it was just going to be in the bathroom.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about the prefrontal cortex and the notion that, being creative sometimes is not so much a matter of harnessing the brain as in getting the brain out of its harness.
Well, the prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain just behind the forehead. And it's often referred to as uniquely human part of the brain. It's the part of the brain that got greatly enlarged during human evolution. And it's essential for something called working memory, which is when you're focused on a task, when you're, you know, trying to go through edits on a poem or perfect a design or go over a draft after draft of a symphony. This is the part of the brain you're engaging.
But when our prefrontal cortex goes off the job and just lets our brains run free, well, we all do that every night. Right? This is what happens when we're dreaming, for example.
Yes. So then the question becomes, well, what happens if you hit the wall? Because we've all got experience with this, right? You're working on a creative problem, and then all of a sudden that feeling of progress disappears. And here's where I think the science was somewhat surprising to me. What you should do then when you hit the wall is get away from your desk. Step away from the office, take a long walk, daydream, find some way to relax, get those alpha waves. Alpha waves are a signal in the brain that's closely correlated with states of relaxation. And what scientists have found is that when people are relaxed, they're much more likely to have those big aha moments, those moments of insight where these seemingly impossible problems get solved. So when you hit the wall, the best thing you can do is probably take a very long, warm shower. The answer will only arrive once you stop looking for it.
Okay. We are raised on the idea that creativity means being original. But time and again in your book, you return to the idea that creativity entails, at its most polite, horizontal patterns of sharing ideas to more commonly just stealing ideas from other people. Is a central element of creativity noticing other stuff that other people have done and using it?
Yeah, I think it's where the brain can actually help illuminate the essence of creativity. The brain is just a endless knot of connections. And a creative thought is simply two cells, a network that's connecting itself in a new way. That sometimes it's triggered by a misreading of an old novel. Sometimes it's triggered by a random thought walking down the street or bumping into someone in the bathroom of the studio. There are all sorts of ways, you know, seemingly old ideas can get reassembled in a new way.
One of the strangest patterns of a creative process that you relate in the book, I thought, was the story of the ad man who came up with the big Nike Just Do It campaign and the phrase, just do it. And he explains how that phrase came to mind, and no one would have expected it.
Yeah, this is a great story from Dan Wyden at Wyden Kennedy, the very honored Portland ad firm. And he tells this great story on, he come up with 7 videos for the new Nike ad campaign, and this in the mid-'80s. But he knew these different videos, which featured different sports, needed a shared slogan. But he just couldn't think of the slogan. And so he'd held all these group meetings with people all throughout the day that held these conversations. And at some point during the day, somebody must have mentioned Norman Mailer to him. And so Norman Mailer was in the back of his head somewhere. And so it's near midnight. His deadline's approaching. He's really, really frustrated at this point because he can't come up with this damn slogan. And then suddenly he thinks of Norman Mailer. And he remembers Norman Mailer wrote this book called The Executioner's Song about Gary Gilmore. And he remembers Gary Gilmore's last words right before he's executed by a firing squad in Utah. His last words were, "Let's do it." And Dan Wyden thinks to himself, geez, that's pretty brave. That's a pretty brave sentiment to have right before you die. Just get it over with. But he realizes "Let's do it" isn't quite right. So he tweaks one word. And there you get Just Do It. That's where Just Do It came from. But that's a perfect example of how, you know, in a sense, that's an old idea. It was a line in a Norman Mailer book. And he tweaked it ever so slightly, substituted one word, and came up with one of the most influential advertising slogans of the second half of the 20th century.
Joan O'Lehrer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joan O'Lehrer's new book is called Imagine: How Creativity Works. Thank you.
The charming rogue and brilliant ad man Don Draper will be back in living rooms this Sunday. Mad Men returns to TV, showcasing the glamour and squalor in a fictional 1960s advertising firm. Seemed like a good time for Renee Montaigne to speak with a real ad man with long experience who joined her from our New York bureau.
That would be George Lois, credited with leading a creative revolution in the late 1950s and 60s. His aim? To create art out of ads. Along the way, he helped make Xerox famous, gave us the cry, "I want my MTV," and had magazine covers collected by the Museum of Modern Art. In his new book, Damn Good Advice, George Lois offers tips from the best of the real Mad Men, some of whom worked in the very building in Manhattan that now houses NPR's bureau.
I walked into this building, and I almost wanted to shock because I realized it was the lobby of the building that I worked at in the late 50s, an agency by the name of Doyle Dane Burbach, which is a renowned, legendary agency. It was the first creative agency that combined the talents of great art direction and the talents of a great writer, synergistically working together to create great ad campaigns.
Well, since you're sitting there in, I guess in a sense, your original stomping grounds, give us an example of one of the ads that would have emerged from that ad agency in that building.
Well, one that thrilled me was probably something like 1957, a great ad campaign for a Levy's Jewish Rye. And the campaign was, "You don't have to be Jewish to love Levy's Jewish Rye." And the visual was a Native American Indian chomping into a sandwich made with Levy's. It was a Chinese waiter chomping into a sandwich. It was a New York Irish policeman chomping into it. What was great about it, and it was kind of signaled to me what real great advertising really should be about, it had a great line that you couldn't forget, and you had a visual going with it, in synergy with it. Those two things together create great advertising.
One of the things you write here is you offer up a formula for advertising. The word must come first. But you've described a perfect kind of ad which marries a word to an image.
Yes, so, that's
but
very,
you still think the word comes first.
Yeah, no, that's very sharp of you. When I talk, and especially when I talk to young people, and I say that when you want to create advertising, you should think in words first. They look at me stunned. They say, no, you create these powerful visual images. Why would you think of copy first? I said, because a line, a slogan should be famous, like I did later with "I Want My MTV." It's one of the most famous slogans of all time. If somebody says to you, "MTV," you think of Mick Jagger on a phone screaming into the phone, "I want my MTV." That, to me, was always the epitome of great advertising.
You tell a story from when you were a teenager in an art class. Tell us that story.
Sure. One of the courses was a pure design course. You'd have an 18 by 24 sheet of paper, and my instructor, Mr. Patterson, said, "Okay, do a design of circles." No concept, just pure circles. The next day were triangles. Then the next day would be triangles and rectangles together. Then on the last day of the year, he gave us another piece of 18 by 24 paper, and he said, "Today, whatever we do, it's going to be half your mark for the season, for the term." Kind of astounding. And he said, "But today, a design of rectangles." And everybody started to work. And where everybody's cutting, they're cutting shapes, and they're all cutting different rectangle shapes. I sat for an hour and 20 minutes, whatever it was, and I did not move. I just sat back, kind of looked out the window, listening for the birds, etc. Finally, after an hour and 20 minutes, he said, "Time's up," and he started to pick up everything, the papers, and he finally came up to me, and he's about to grab it, and I stopped. I put my hand down and said, "Excuse me, wait for a second." And I wrote G. Lois in the corner of this perfect 18 by 24 rectangle. And he tore it out of my hands, and I said, "Oh, my God." I went home. I said, "Oh, my God." He didn't get it. I came in the next morning, and there were four or five teachers in the hallway. Saw me and said, "George, oh, my God, George, what you did in Mr. Patterson's class was brilliant." What I taught myself was that in any problem you get, you got to come up with an innovative, brilliant, kind of unusual, stunning solution.
Give us an example of how you take this level of creativity and apply it to something that's as simple as Aunt Jemima's What was it? What was
Aunt syrup?
Yes, syrup. But until you came along, Aunt Jemima wasn't known for syrup. That product was known for pancake
mix.
Yeah,
I was working for the Aunt Jemima people, and I said to them, how come you guys don't have a syrup? You own the pancake business. And they said, well, that's not our business. And they come up with 12 reasons why they don't have it. And I said to them two or three times over a couple of months, and they said, stop talking about it, Aunt Jemima syrup. So finally what I did is I came up with a piece of research with my account executives about Aunt Jemima pancake. Aunt Jemima pancake, do you do this? How do you do this with pancakes? And do you do this? What do you buy? Blah, 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 blah. The last question in this questionnaire about pancakes listed a bunch of syrups, and I included the words Aunt Jemima syrup. And I said, which of these syrups have you bought in the last year? And something like 90% of the people or so circled that they had bought Aunt Jemima syrup, which was non-existent. And I took that research to the head guys, and I said, I want to talk to you about syrup. And they said, not again. And I showed them the research, and I said that 90% of the Americans believe they are already buying Aunt Jemima syrup. Would you please make Aunt Jemima syrup? And, of course, they created the syrup, and they became the leading syrup brand in the world, you know, in 2 days. You know, so creativity comes in. My defining statement about creativity, in fact, is in the opening pages of the book. I have in very bold type, creativity can solve almost any problem. The creative act, the defeat of habit by originality, overcomes everything. And I really believe that. And what I try to teach young people or anybody in any creative field is that every idea should seemingly be outrageous.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, Renee. Thanks very much.
Ad Man George Lois. His new book is called Damn Good Advice.
And you can see some of George Lois's successful ad campaigns at npr.org.
Book critic Maureen Carrigan says two just-published books on New York City and crime are potent antidotes to lazy nostalgia about the good old days.
Some years ago, I was visiting Disneyland and had a culture clash encounter there with one of my fellow Americans. I was standing with my daughter on the miles-long meandering line for It's a Small World After All, and I fell into a conversation with another mom. When this woman found out I was a native New Yorker, she treated me to her verdict on the city. It's so dirty there. Well, yeah, of course it's dirty. Dirt is the price you pay for a place being interesting. If, unlike that woman, you want to know anything about America's greatest city, you've got to be willing to get grimy. Two new books about New York, a novel and a narrative history, do more than put up with filth. They positively wallow in it. Anyone looking for some good, unclean literary fun should step right up and lay their money down. It's been almost 20 years since Caleb Carr's best-selling old New York crime novel, The Alienist, was published, and I can't count the number of times since then that someone has asked me if I can recommend a suspense story anything like it. Well, New York has inspired lots of terrific thrillers, but I've just stumbled on one of the worthiest successors yet. Lindsay Fay's novel, The Gods of Gotham, is set in 1845, a year that transformed New York for two reasons. It saw the founding of the city's first police force, and it marked the failure of the potato crop in Ireland. The ensuing Great Famine propelled hundreds of thousands of Irish immigrants over to America, where many landed deep in the muck of New York City. Fay clearly revels in crowded period detail and in pre-CSI methods of deduction. Her narrator is named Timothy Wilde, and after a fire destroys the oyster cellar where he tends bar, Wilde reluctantly pins on a copper star and begins working the standard 16-hour police shift. His beat, the infamous Five Points neighborhood that was the setting for the Martin Scorsese film Gangs of New York. On one of his first patrols, Wilde runs into a panicked 10-year-old girl covered in blood. That gory encounter sends our rookie on an investigation into the secret lives of some of New York's most upstanding citizens. One of the most entertaining aspects of The Gods of Gotham is its language. Faye imbues her tale with period criminal slang. Thus, a hen is a woman, a squeaker a child, and a stargazer a prostitute. If I had had this lingo handy at Disney World, I could have told that New York City critic to stow your wid, meaning be silent. The classic contest of cops versus criminals also provides the plot of Richard Zax's Island of Vice. This fascinating narrative history traces Theodore Roosevelt's doomed struggle to put a lid on crime in New York during his tenure as police commissioner starting in 1895. Zax follows T.R. and other reformers along on their nighttime rambles into the New York underworld. Smut of all sorts prevailed. For instance, months after Edison invented the phonograph, X-rated wax cylinder recordings were being produced to be played through ear tubes for a nickel a listen in saloons and arcades. Some 40,000 prostitutes wandered nightly around the city's neighborhoods, and New York's finest had gotten a solid reputation for corruption. The press of the day dubbed them New York's filthiest. Into this chaos rode Theodore Roosevelt. One of the achievements of Island of Vice is that Zax penetrates beneath the bluster into the psychology of this strange, restless man. Roosevelt was hell-bent on cleaning up the police force, and he enjoyed a mixed success. He was also determined to enforce Sunday Blue laws against drinking, a campaign that was so unpopular, New York City never forgave T.R. and did its best to end his political career before it really began. Zax humanizes Teddy's obsession, describing how it was sparked by his awareness of the role alcohol had played in the pathetic downfall of his brother Elliot. In addition to his observations about T.R., Zax also has plenty of smart insights into the enduring enigma that is New York City. The very last sentence of his book is a gem. Zax says, "Like in ancient Rome, the vitality of New York City sometimes seems to come more from the crooks than the do-gooders." Depending on how you feel about the city, that judgment will either confirm your worst prejudices or slap a crooked grin of appreciation on your face.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Gods of Gotham by Lindsay Fay and Island of Vice, Theodore Roosevelt's doomed quest to clean up sin-loving New York by Richard Zax.
As a 21-year-old in New Jersey, Kevin Smith decided he wanted to be a filmmaker. His sister gave him advice. Don't say you want to be a filmmaker, just be one. He did. With hardly any money at all in movie terms, Kevin Smith made Clerks at a convenience store where he worked about guys like him who'd rather talk about Star Wars than work.
What did you like better, Jedi or The Empire Strikes Back?
Empire.
Blasphemy.
Empire had the better ending. I mean, Luke gets his hand cut off, finds out Vader's his father, hand gets frozen and taken away by Boba Fett. It ends on such a down note. I mean, that's what life is, a series of down endings.
Kevin Smith has gone on to a quirky and distinguished career, including movies like Chasing Amy and Dogma. So it is of some note that the guy who just decided to be a filmmaker has now decided to stop being one. Mr. Smith tries to explain this in a new book whose title is as profane as some of his movies, a title that is actually bleeped on the cover, so which we cannot say it on the radio, except that the first of the two words in the title is tough. Mr. Smith, welcome to the program.
The second one, we could go with, you know, it's a good interjection for radio. Let's call it Tough Smith.
I like it. Tough Smith.
And most people, you know, my critics would tell you, like, those words are interchangeable.
Oh,
so
well,
it actually works out. It's weird. I was listening to the intro, and that's 20 years ago now. I'm 41, so it was 20 years ago that my sister was like, be a filmmaker, and I kind of went for it. But 20 years later, man, you will find no end of people who are like, well, we're still waiting for you to be a filmmaker.
Well, you know. I'm not one of them. I loved Clerks, and there have been many distinguished films since. A few that have been panned as well, but that's life. Why stop making movies?
You know, for me, it was never about, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. I was 21, I saw Richard Linklater's film Slacker, and it moved me. I said, if this guy could tell stories about his people in Nowheresville, USA, which turned out to be Austin, Texas. A lot of people seem to know it. I didn't at the time. Mm-hmm. Didn't know it was the state capital of Texas either. But this guy made a movie on his own, and that inspired me. I said, this is what I want to do. You know, it's like I think so many of us, we get the golden ticket, and we're like, we're just going to do this until we go toes up off this planet.
But sure.
For me, it was like, I want to tell these stories. I'd see movies, comedies, and I loved Animal House. I loved all the John Hughes stuff. But I never saw me and my friends totally represented. Our wacky misadventures weren't nearly cinematic. You know, it wasn't like, we're taking on a dean. It was more like, we're going to sit around and talk about Star Wars for like way too many hours without booze or drugs. Like, that becomes the booze and drug. So I said, let me create that. And then I went out and made Clerks and stuff. And those movies now, throw a rock, you hit a movie like that.
But let's talk about this. You're still a creative guy. You've gotten into podcasting in a big way. If people don't know that, you're into other creative endeavors. You're still having to come up with ideas, come up
absolutely
with thoughts.
But I get to take them into other arenas. I think about my father, as you know, in the book, I talk about my father quite a bit. But my father didn't have the luxury of going, you know, at a certain point, 20 years into his career, I'm going to change horses midstream. He had one job.
That job was?
He worked at the U.S. Postal Service, and we were so proud of him because he never shot anybody. You know what I'm saying? One of the few postal clerks who ever made it through the system without going postal on anybody.
Now, come on.
Well, that was
one of the few. Come on.
All right, one of the many. But he hated the job. He absolutely hated it.
But you're saying that this was actually a fear you had.
Well, it wasn't so much a fear, but like I watched my father kind of wake up and not want to go to work, and I just said, I don't want to do that. I'll work, but that work's got to be something that I like. And with film, I did that for a while. And film is like a slot machine if you find the right one. And boy, did we with Miramax and Clerks and Harvey Weinstein.
Well, let's talk about Harvey Weinstein. This is a guy who bought your first film, who guided your career in many ways. You praise him in many ways, but you also seem to have had some difficult times with him.
The relationship I had with Harvey was definitely more like that father-son relationship that you read about in literature and whatnot. I love him to death, but yeah, I've definitely had some issues along
Oedipus,
the way.
That's what you're thinking here.
I guess. But does that mean I want to have sex with him? Because I don't want to have sex with Harvey.
I think it's killing your father. That would be the Oedipal.
Boy, I've had it wrong forever. You're really turning me around here, man. I don't know how I got this far,
Maybe now you've got an idea for a film you've got to go make before you're done.
Yeah, Hollywood, I'm back.
Well, what went wrong in that relationship with Harvey Weinstein?
It wasn't so much what went wrong. It's you know what it was? I was an idealist. I was a young man, and I believed kind of everything I was told. And back in those days, we were told, like, this is indie war, man. We're taking on the studios. They're making commercial crap, and we're making art. But you know what happens is a good idea becomes a business. And suddenly there was a day where I was like, we're listening to marketing data that you're getting based on trailers, not even like test screening a movie. We're test screening trailers and poster images. There's no more gut instinct in this.
Well, there is the question of your brand. You write about Harvey Weinstein having a particular brand as a head of a studio and maybe damaging that brand over time. You, I think it's fair to say, have a particular brand as a filmmaker. People have some idea of the kind of film that you have made up to now.
Yeah.
Now you're in these other forms of entertainment and art. What do you think is the Kevin Smith brand?
I've been trying to figure that out, man. It's not filmmaking anymore. And, you know, you're not talking about the mainstream. You're talking about people who are kind of into the stuff I do, which is enough for me to build an entire career on. Like, that's what I figured out. I was just like, you know what, man, I've got this audience and they like the films, but they like when I do Q&As as well. They just like whatever I do. So the audience made me feel safe enough to step away from filmmaking. It's weird. You feel conflicted as an artist, right? Mm-hmm. You want an audience, but ideally, you don't want them to have to pay for what you do. You want to give it away, dude. That's where the podcasting came from. I was like, this is a way where you just give it away for free. And the podcasting, I swear to you, on its worst day, the podcasts are better than our best films because they're more imaginative and there's no artifice and it's far more real.
Do you worry at all that at some point in the future, after you stop making films, that you, well, that you kind of become like Kim Kardashian, just somebody who people, they know the name. They're not quite even sure why they know the name. Just somebody famous.
You know, yeah, I guess there's the kind of Kim Kardashian version of that where you're just like, ugh, she's kind of known for being herself. But to be fair, one of the greatest reality shows like we ever watch in this country is about the president. He leads it every day, and we seem interested in that. So he's the opposite end of the spectrum. So I feel like I fall somewhere between the president and Kim Kardashian. And that's an okay place to be, man. It's a lot further than I ever thought I'd get as a fat kid, I'll tell you that much.
Kevin Smith's new book has a title we cannot quite say on the air, so let's euphemize it, as he suggests, as Tough Smith. The subtitle is Life Advice from a Fat, Lazy Slob Who Did Good. Mr. Smith, a pleasure to talk with you again.
Pleasure, sir.
All right, Kevin Smith is at work on what he says is his last movie, the hockey comedy Hit Somebody, which is due out next year.